Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, where we are reminded over and over again that freedom isn't free. Each time we visit with World War II veterans, the idea to honor them for their service, their sacrifice, to preserve their stories so they're not forgotten, so we don't forget how great a price has been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we're always educated, often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. These guys don't want to be called heroes, but it has become crystal clear to me that no matter where your hometown is in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small it might be, those heroes are there, next door, around the corner, down the street. And unless we ask, we have no idea what kind of things they've endured on our behalf. Usually I visit the veterans in their homes to ask those kinds of questions, but this week's show's a little different. Interviewing a veteran a week for the last 8 years, I've had the privilege of meeting some pretty incredible people. And I've come across some veterans organizations whose commitment and dedication are impossible to miss. The Wahoo base of U.S. submarine veterans definitely fits that description. And these fine submariners from Central California invited me to tag along on a bus ride to San Francisco last weekend. That will be the setting for the show today. We're going to hear from a Modesto man who served on a submarine during World War II and squeezed his 89-year-old body through those tiny hatches again last weekend. He was able to do that because Pier 45 at San Francisco's Fisherman's Wharf is home to a couple other World War II veterans we'll be discussing today. They can't speak, but boy, do they have some stories. And they give you a chance to experience World War II history on a daily basis. I'm talking about the Liberty Ship, SS Jeremiah O'Brien, and the Baleo-class submarine USS Pampanito, part of the San Francisco Maritime National Historic Park. We've heard from a fair number of submariners over the years on Hometown Heroes, but I got to tell you, it adds a whole new dimension to the stories they've shared when you step into the cramped quarters of a World War II submarine for yourself and imagine being in that spot as some of those tense moments we've heard about unfolded. Thanks to Ted Dick, Robert Houck, and the rest of my friends from the Wahoo base, I had that opportunity last week, and I hope you get to experience it sometime too. That particular boat, don't call it a ship to a submariner, it's a boat, the Pampanito had some interesting chapters in the impressive record of submarines in World War II. Did you know that even though submarine personnel made up less than 2% of our armed forces in World War II, submarines were responsible for 55% of all the enemy shipping destroyed. That's pretty impressive, but it was also very risky and proved very costly. These numbers illustrate that. 52 submarines, one out of every five subs that made patrols in World War II, 52 submarines were lost. On those 52 subs, more than 3,500 men died. That's one out of every seven submariners. And those men all volunteered for submarine duty. Visit the Pampanito in San Francisco, and you'll be walking, and if you're 6'3 like I am, ducking on a boat that made six patrols during World War II. The Pampanito sank six Japanese ships and damaged four others. You can examine the torpedo tubes that made all that possible and learn the story of how the Pampanito and two other subs attacked a Japanese convoy in September 1944, only to learn afterwards that there were over 2,000 British and Australian prisoners of war on those Japanese ships. The Pampanito returned to the area and was able to rescue 73 of those POWs, and you can actually watch online footage from that rescue shot through periscope cameras back in 1944. The Pampanito is preserved as it was when the war ended in 1945, and it's kept in terrific shape by a great crew of volunteers. The day I was there, I encountered visitors from several different countries climbing down into the Pampanito, but I don't think any of them could experience it the way the man we're about to hear from did. Harold Molnix, originally from Colorado, but a longtime resident of Modesto, California, where his friends and neighbors know him simply as Hal. Hal is a submarine veteran of World War II. He toured the Pampanito with other submariners from the Wahoo base, and when he was done, I sat down next to him on a bench in the middle of Fisherman's Wharf to get a little of his story. If you hear a little background noise at some point, that location might explain it. Let's hear from 89-year-old Hal Molnix. Well, let's go way, way back, more than 70 years back. What do you remember growing up in Colorado? You were there in Aurora, just outside of Denver. What was life like?
Life was a very small town, nothing exciting, no school buses. Most of the time they had to walk. There was very little problem as far as people are concerned. It was just a very nice small community in Aurora.
You had been in high school when December 7th, 1941 rolled around. I like to ask every veteran about that because everybody seems to remember something. What do you remember about that day and how you found out that Pearl Harbor had been attacked?
Well, that day I was going across the viaduct in downtown Denver. Another friend of I and myself and two girls were on the way to a movie when we heard it on the radio, and so we turned around and went back home again. And was, you know, very, very surprised and very concerned, you know, about whatever was happening. So it was just a complete surprise with us and everybody else. So that's what we were doing on that particular day.
And did you have any inkling at that point that you were going to somehow become part of this war that was starting?
Aurora didn't have its own paper, so it was the Denver Post, and I don't remember anything that would indicate that there was going to be that kind of a problem. No, I just never thought anything would be like that at all.
But before long, you would be involved, and you told me you'd had a fascination or an interest in the Navy for some time?
Yes, I did. I had a cousin who was career Navy, and he'd come and visit us once in a while, and through him and talking to him and things, you know, that went on, I became very interested in the Navy. So when the war broke out and I wanted to go into the service, so I went down to the volunteer in Denver, and they said since I was so close to graduation, which would be the following May, that they had me wait until I graduated, and then I went right into the Navy from then.
You were so willing to go and ready that you tried to not even finish high school.
Well, I actually did graduate May the 30th, and I was in boot camp in June the 10th in San Diego. I volunteered for 6 years. That may have been one reason why I was accepted in the submarine service, because I volunteered for submarines when I was still in boot camp. So after all the testing and everything, they sent me right to electrical school in St. Louis.
Why did you volunteer for submarines? Because I think people today have an idea of submarines that is quite different from what it was in World War II. I mean, this is pretty unproven stuff, pretty risky stuff. What about the submarine service at that point made you say, yeah, I want to do that?
Well, I don't know whether it was that or whether I was figuring out maybe if I went submarines, I might not get seasick if I went to sea. I don't really remember why, but submarines had really interested me from talking to my cousin who was in the Navy. And so I just thought maybe I could get into that. So that's why I volunteered.
Of all the training that you had to go through to prepare for what you eventually did, what do you remember being the toughest element of that?
I had lots of schooling on going to electrical school. And then when I went to submarine school in New London, Connecticut, maybe the hardest thing that I thought was going to be was going up through the tower and the escape through there. I made the 100-foot ascent, I think, was probably the second try. So at first I thought that was going to be really tough, but fortunately it didn't seem to be for me. I don't know.
You never had to do that for real, right?
No. No problems with that. And even on our war patrols, we never, I didn't feel we were in serious trouble. The last patrol probably was the closest we came to that, when we were under attack for probably about 12 hours. And we had, according to the captain's log, we had 189 attempts to sink us with the escorts that were following the convoy. And then when they used all their depth charges, then they'd go back to fill up with, and they'd aircraft from the Japan would come out. So according to the captain's log, between the aerial bombs and depth charges, they made 189 attempts to sink us. So that was probably the hairiest time that I can remember.
Yeah, and I want to come back to that, but You're talking about the USS Sturgeon, a Salmon-class submarine, and I want to get your impressions of that boat. Not a ship. You're talking to a submariner. It's a boat. And it had a pretty good story from the start of the war. It was actually out at sea during Pearl Harbor and came up with a clever encapsulation of its early action, I hear.
She was at the dock in Pearl, not in Pearl Harbor, in the Philippine Islands when the war broke out. So she went right to sea when the war was declared. I wasn't on her, but when she sunk her first ship, she sent back a message to Comm Subpack that the Virgin Sturgeon was no longer a virgin. So that's, I understand that also appeared with some kind of a report after during the war or something like that. It was reported to the public so that they knew that this was what happened.
And you came aboard the Sturgeon in October of 1943, right?
I'd finished submarine school and was transferred to San Francisco. The Sturgeon was coming out of dry dock at Hunters Point, San Francisco. And I had been assigned to the boat. That's where I first went aboard her.
Was there any kind of indoctrination or anything that you had to do to get in the good graces of the sailors who had been on there for a while?
Not really that I can remember. I didn't feel that I was, tested or anything like that. All the guys that I met, right at the beginning of the boat tour was real good buddies. I did have a problem with the chief electrician on the boat. He and I didn't get along very well, so every chance he got, he put me to mess cooking. And when we went to sea on our first patrol, one of the cooks had a real problem with slicing his hand with when he was doing some in the galley. And I'd gotten real well acquainted with all the guys there, so anyway, they said if I'd help him with a watch in the galley, that they'd help me and get me a rate when I came out. So that's what I did, and that's why I went from electrician striker to a ship's cook.
What about the camaraderie on the boat at the USS Pampanito here that you've just toured with the rest of the guys from the Wahoo base? There's a big picture outside the boat that says 80 men, 75 days, no showers. What was life like on that World War II submarine?
They pretty well described that. Most of our boats things weren't quite that long, but yeah, we could get freshwater showers at the very beginning, but then once we got to sea and been in sea for quite some time, it was saltwater showers. And not too often, but other than that, it was great, and all the guys put up with everybody else, so I don't remember there being a real problem as far as the guys are concerned with each other.
Today's submarines can stay submerged for weeks and months on end, but in World War II with those diesel subs, you would have to surface on a daily basis. How often did you guys actually dive, and were those nerve-wracking moments? What did it feel like to know you were going under, and there was probably a reason for that?
I don't remember feeling any real problems with that. Yeah, we did have daily dives so that we could charge the batteries and take care of other things. But I don't remember anybody on the boat that ever expressed real fear or anything like that when we made our dives. And I don't remember myself feeling any fear.
When you look back now and you see the statistics about the percentage of submariners who died during World War II, do you look back and say, maybe I should have been more concerned for myself?
Well, I never really thought about it. And my problem was that when I got out of the Navy, I was completely away from that for several years. And in fact, I probably was about 10 or 15 years after I'd been out of the Navy that I even found out that the submarines sailors had a retired group, and the meetings and so forth. All of that things that were maybe in my mind when I left the Navy was pretty much behind that, because I didn't talk to any sailors, I didn't talk to anybody like that. So a lot of the things that happened aboard the boat I really don't remember a lot of.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. And we're thankful you're sharing the things you do remember with us today, giving us a taste of life aboard a submarine in World War II. More with Mr. Molnix when we come back. And before we're done, we're going to hear about another impressive example of history preserved at San Francisco's Pier 45, the Liberty ship Jeremiah O'Brien. This weekend is actually what they call a steaming weekend. You can actually see the O'Brien steam-powered engine in action. Boy, is that impressive. If you watch the movie Titanic, you've already seen the engine room. We'll hear all about it before we're done. You know, the Jeremiah O'Brien was at Normandy on D-Day. And in a moment, I'm going to tell you how you can help a Central California group participate in the 70th anniversary of D-Day next June. Hometown Heroes will be right back at you after this. Central California has plenty of talented musicians. That's not news. But this is. 45 musicians from the area are hoping to head to Normandy next June to take part in the 70th anniversary commemoration of the D-Day landings. They'll represent the Clovis Community Band. Clovis Mayor Lynn Ashbeck will go along, and the Clovis Veterans Memorial District has given them a great head start on their fundraising goal. I've got the perfect way for you to help, too. All you have to do is eat some delicious food catered by Pardini's, enjoy some outstanding music that Joe Lennigan Band will perform. You can dance to your heart's content, and there are some pretty impressive auction items you might want to bid on, too. It's the Night to Remember Dinner Dance, Saturday night, August 17th in Clovis, and all the proceeds will help make these dedicated local musicians a special part of D-Day's 70th anniversary. To reserve your tickets for the dinner dance, call 559-431-3160. That's 559-431-3160. And go online to find out more about this sentimental journey by visiting clovis community band dday.org.